And we continue at 106 in the afternoon, Talk Radio 790 KABC, the John Phillips Show, broadcasting live in exile from the Morongo Casino Resort and Spa Living Room Studios, and it's time to fully reopen the state of California for business. Mr. Randy Wang's at the sports desk in Culver City.
John, today marks the 30th anniversary of the L.A. riots back in April of 1992. Local news channels across the board are all showing footage from that day and week in history. And one thing is clear. People in the early 90s had really, really terrible haircuts.
Lots of perms back then.
Especially the reporters that are still working today, showing what they looked like 30 years ago. It's a good chuckle on a bad day in history.
You know, it's funny because you go back to certain eras. You go back to, say, the 1960s, and you look at news clips from back then. And by today's standards, they were dressed fashionable, and they had fashionable haircuts, and everything looked prim and proper. You go to the 1970s and people are doing the news in lime green leisure suits.
We've seen a couple of pictures of Steve Edwards looking like that.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of television news, it is a pleasure to welcome our next guest to the program. He is a former KCBS-TV LA-based reporter. You spent decades watching him on the local news. He's also author of a brand new book that's out right now. It's called It's a Great Life If You Don't Weaken. Family, Faith, and 48 Years on Television. You can get it online at Amazon.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at CBSLA, Dave Lopez. Dave Lopez, welcome.
Well, thank you, John, very much. I appreciate that. And if I may, I also did an audiobook, so that's available. It's also available on Kindle. And, you know, you're talking about 30 years ago today. I dedicate a chapter in the book to my experiences on that day, April 29th, 1992. I was assigned to the AME Church, and it was a day that I'll never forget, and a day, quite frankly, that I felt that I was lucky that no one in my crew got hurt.
How dangerous was it when you were broadcasting live during the L.A. riots?
It was brutal. I mean, that first night, I've lived all my life in Southern California. I was born and raised here. I'm old enough to remember vividly the Watts riots of 1965. I was a 17-year-old kid ready to go to my senior year in high school. But the Rodney King riots, in my opinion, were far more dangerous. It was absolute chaos, total chaos. What happened to us very quickly, I had two different cameramen that day, and I was at the AME Church, and there was fire all around. One of them took off because he wanted to get some close-ups of a gas station on fire, and I told him not to go. And sure enough, he comes back 10 minutes later with a big gash on his forehead. He was hit with a 2x4, and his camera was gone. My other cameraman was in the parking lot trying to get a live signal. Why, I don't know. But a group of about 25 to 30 young men were surrounding him, and they were trying to tip the truck over. When all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes Jim Hill, our very famous newscaster, Jim, sportscaster, everybody knows Jim. Jim pops out. I look at him. I say, Jim. And he goes, hold on. Walks over there and he says, I'm Jim Hill. Everybody's making a big fuss. And he says, this is my buddy Lopez here. He's a good guy. Leave him alone. And the crowd dispersed. And about 10 minutes later, my cameraman comes out, Wilson Posey, very shaken. And I asked Jim, what made you come by that night? He says, I just thought you were in trouble and needed help. He was the savior. He was our knight in shining armor that night. I'll never forget that. And for the next 5 days, it was nothing but chaos, John. I mean, we would go all over Southern California. Firefighters would show up where there was a fire, and then when the crowd came out and started throwing things at them, they'd leave. They thought it was too dangerous to stick around. I never saw anything like that in my life. It was absolute bedlam, chaos, and I never felt that I was going to be attacked, but I certainly did not feel comfortable.
And there were police officers and firefighters and emergency responders who would be attempting to put out a fire, and you'd have camera crews and reporters who were there covering the fire and covering whatever chaos was going on, and they were shot at when they were doing their jobs. Typically speaking, you don't report on firefighters being shot at when they're trying to put the fire out because everyone wants the fire to be put out, but times were different back then and people were on edge.
Yeah, and what really added to the problem, there was actually one firefighter who was shot that night. I mean, it was really bad. I mean, it was a terrible situation. People were angry, looting everywhere. But what really added to the situation at the time, Mayor Bradley was the mayor of Los Angeles and Daryl Gates was the police chief. And they hadn't spoken to each other in a year. And there was a great deal of tension. And, I mean, people were just literally throwing up their hands. And thank goodness that calm prevailed after a while. But, you know, I look back at that and I, you know, people always ask me, well, could it happen again? I don't know. I mean, I'm not in tune to the community as much as I used to be, so I really don't think I can answer that question totally accurately. I can just go on my perceptions, and it's bad out there. I mean, there is tension, and as long as you have that ill feeling between the police and the community, you're always going to have a potential for problems.
And whenever you have a rising crime rate in general, news vans and news reporters aren't immune to being the victims of crime. We've seen recently up in the Bay Area, Northern California, where news crew after news crew after news crew has been robbed, where they want the cameras, or if you're out, you're doing a story, they'll break into the news van while you're shooting your story and they'll steal the contents of the news van. And they've really been put in harm's way.
Very much so. That's one thing that I go into in the book. I mean, you know, I started in this town in 1972. April 12, 1972 was my first assignment. I covered George McGovern was running for president at the time, and he was making a campaign stop in April. I covered that. So that's how far back I go. I don't remember when it changed or when we as journalists in the field had to worry about being a target. But it got to the point later on where we couldn't, you know, we used to color the TV crews, you know, put the mask on and I mean, put the logo of the station and what have you. It's gotten to the point now where many stations don't do that anymore for fear that they'll be attacked. I really can't pinpoint it when it happened, but in the latter part of my career, I noticed a real change. I mean, people used to enjoy coming up to us and talking to us. They would help us. They thought it was a big deal going on television. But that attitude changed dramatically in the last couple of years that I worked on TV. I could sense that we more or less became the enemies rather than people who could help out. I mean, not everybody, but I mean, that sense was very, very prevalent. And I touch on that a little bit in my book. And you know, whether it was social media that changed all of this, I don't know. But it certainly changed a great deal since when I first broke in.
We're speaking with Dave Lopez, author of It's a Great Life If You Don't Weaken, Family, Faith, and 48 Years on Television, available online at Amazon.com. As someone who has worked in Southern California and lived here his entire life and worked here on the television newscast since the 1970s, what would you say is the biggest change that you've seen in Southern California in that time period?
The disappearance of the middle class, you know, there was a time when moms didn't have to always work. You didn't have to have the double income. Dad didn't have to work as many overtime hours as he wanted to. You had a much stronger family fabric, at least in my opinion. That's what I saw. The middle class neighborhood where it was obvious that, you know, people had a good life. They were able to do things. A lot of that's disappearing. I mean, it's you know, it's either the haves or the have-nots now. The other thing in my travels, I notice a great discrepancy in the way schools look. I mean, you know, the richer areas certainly have the nice, pristine-looking schools, and those in the poorer areas do not. That's one of the reasons why, I mentioned it in my book, I started a scholarship in memory of my late wife, who was a school teacher, and I wanted to do something to perpetuate her memory. And being a school teacher, I was able to find a school on the campus of Harvard Junior College, and it's called the Bladovic Harvard Teacher Prep Academy, where kids go there. It's not a charter school, but it's a school where you apply. Most of the kids who go there want to become teachers, and for the last 8 years, this will be our ninth year, I've given a scholarship to the top student who wants to be a teacher. We've been fortunate enough to fund ourselves. We give away $10,000 to the winner, $2,000 prizes. And it's something I'm very proud of. And it's just my way, I think, of helping people who need help. You ask the biggest change. It's the fact that so many kids today who really want to go to school and who have an opportunity to go to school, the money's just not there. And they just have no way of knowing how they can help themselves. So, That's what I miss. I miss the L.A. where you can walk at night, not have to worry, walk to school, walk to the park, ride your bike, leave your bike there, not have to, you know, bolt it down, be able to, you know, just be free and safe. That's, you know, that's not like Pollyanna, don't I?
Well, to that point, as a reporter who was married to a teacher, someone who spent his life here, raised his family here, given everything that you just described about the shrinking and disappearing middle class, if you were starting your career today as opposed to in the 1970s, and you were surveying the cost of living, you were surveying the quality of schools, the crime rate, the homeless numbers, all of these sorts of things, do you think you would have planted your roots here in Southern California, or do you think you would have looked somewhere else?
Well, I certainly would have given a second thought. I mean, to be honest with you, this is not the Los Angeles I grew up in, far from it. I mean, especially with the homeless situation. No, to answer your question, I probably would have looked somewhere else. And the way the news business is today, I don't know if anybody will ever last 48 years again. It's just a much different profession now. I always quote Don Hewitt saying that I'm a 20th century man being dragged to the 21st century. You know, it was Twitter and Zoom and Instagram and God knows everything else that you have. I mean, it wasn't my cup of tea. But no, it's very difficult. It's very tough. Both my kids went to public school. They went to Downey High School. Excellence education, no problem at all. They were both very intelligent. They took after their mother, not me. And they both went to UC school. You know, they both went to UC schools. My son went to UCLA. My daughter went to UC San Diego. She went on to law school. My son became very, very prominent in his field, in the salesman of hearing aid equipment. And they made it. But the big key, John, and again, I point it out in my book because I was raised with a very strong family background. My mom and dad were immigrants from Mexico. My father was a prominent businessman, both high school education. Both of them spoke very little English when they came here at a very young age. But they knew the American dream and they pursued it. My father worked very hard. My mother kept the house. We never had to worry about where things were going to come from because we had this background. They were always there. We weren't, you know, taken to a babysitter. We weren't, you know, I never heard my mom and dad complain about money issues. I mean, they were just hardworking people, and they instilled that in us. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book the way I did, talking a lot about my background, was everything that has been successful for me.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free. See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
And all my brothers and sisters, there's eight of us, started with my mom and dad, who gave us that strong background, and we knew they were always going to be there for us. Which I think is so critical today. You got to have that strong family unit, and church was important. I mean, religion was important for us, and it's carried on. At least I'm 74 years old now, and I'm very proud to say that I would not feel comfortable if I missed church. I just wouldn't do it.
Let's talk about Southern California in terms of, you mentioned your parents came here from Mexico. That is a very common story with so many people who live here. They came here from a different country looking for better opportunities. They were watching the Rose Bowl with snow outside, and they said, what the hell am I doing in Pennsylvania when I could be living there? People come here to make it in Hollywood. They come here for a lot of different reasons. People like you and me, people who were born here, who grew up here, that's not the common type of median person that you'll run into on the street. Typically, people come to California from some other place to strike it rich or have their little slice of Americana, their little slice of the pie. And that was always the case going all the way back to the gold rush here in California. Because there are so many people here from so many other places, it seems to me like sometimes the politicians take advantage of that. In recent days, I've heard claims made by Gavin Newsom and the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, where they said that crime is lower today than it was in the 1960s, that it's safer today than it was in the 1960s. And the other claim that I just heard was that homelessness was worse in the early 2000s than it is today. And I say to myself, anyone who's lived here for a long period of time just laughs when they hear something like that, because I can't remember a time, and I've lived here my whole life, when crime was this bad or when homelessness was this bad.
No, I mean, John, it was a much different era, and I totally agree with you. First of all, I mean, can you imagine today having a kid who's 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, walking to school by himself to and fro, riding his bike to a park and running around in the park, going to a grocery store and, buying things for your mom and dad, whatever they wanted, and you come back home and you're fine. Walking at night, walking home from the gym. I mean, even driving the freeway sometimes. You can look at somebody across sideways, you're going to get shot at. You know, so no, I mean, it's a much different way of living. When I was a kid, we would always go for a Sunday drive and go to my grandma's house. And my father would always make it a point, not every week, but more so than not, he'd take us by Skid Row. And Skid Row, when I was a kid growing up, was, on 4th Street. Not far from downtown. It's where it is now. That was basically Skid Row. You didn't see homeless people all over the city. But my dad would drive us by there, and he would say, take a good look. If you don't study hard, if you don't work hard, this is how you can end up. And then he would take us to Chavez Ravine before Dodger Stadium was built. It was Chavez Ravine. And again, they had ramshackle places. The same thing. He said, you don't want to learn. You don't want to go to school. You don't want to work hard. You can live like this. And, you know, for an 8-9-year-old kid sitting in the back of the station wagon, our eyes would just rivet and pop open. And so all those lessons he taught us, it was a given that we were going to go to college and do the best we could. He always taught us the golden rules, you know, be kind to everyone. Don't take something that doesn't belong to you, all that kind of stuff. And I think all those values are lost now. I mean, it's a totally different way of living. But, you know, for the mayor or the governor to say things that it's safer now than it was before, that's baloney. I mean, they're not living in reality. It's far from it.
We're speaking with Dave Lopez, author of It's a Great Life If You Don't Weaken, Family, Faith, and 48 Years on Television. Dave, one of the questions I get all the time is about political bias when it comes to news media. And people always say, where can I go to get the straight news? And I always give them the same answer. I always say, watch a local newscast. You watch the cable channels, those are talk shows. Those aren't really newscasts. They book people well before what they know the topics are going to be, and they're essentially doing talk shows. And depending on which channel you're watching, there's a different political slant to the show. Sometimes the political slant changes from show to show on the same network. But you look at your local news, and the news on the local newscasts are far more relevant to your life, and they don't have the time or the resources to throw a hard slant on it. They tell you what crime is going on in your area. They tell you about what events are going on in your area. They cover the local politicians, news, weather, traffic, entertainment, and then 30 minutes it's over, and they're essentially repeating the same thing again 30 minutes later. Do you feel the same way about local news?
Well, the way it is now, I mean, and again, I don't want to start by saying, oh, well, back in my day, you know, but it was. Look, I go back to 1972. I go back to the giants of this industry. Where, I mean, in order to work in Los Angeles at that time, you had to be a top-notch professional in your field. I mean, there was no room for any rookies. I was 24 years old. I knew I was young. I knew I was inexperienced, and I watched and studied these guys. I was very lucky to work with people like Joe Benti, Phil Stout, top-notch professionals. Behind the scenes, a guy named Pete Noyes. And we were drilled. We were drilled that we had to be right down the middle. You tell a story, you tell both sides of the story as best you can, and the best compliment you could get is that the people who are watching you do whatever story you may do, especially if it was political, they couldn't tell if you were a Republican or a Democrat. That's the way they wanted it to be. I mean, we had guidelines in CBS. We had a blue book that we used to, all reporters had a blue book, and we had to study that thing, and we had to abide by the rules. We were told, and if we were caught doing it, we would have to do the story again. When we're interviewing someone, we couldn't even be seen on the cutaways nodding our head. We did not want to give any appearance that we were either a green or not a green or whatever. But they said, play it straight, play it right down the vest. Is that today, every day? I don't see it. But you know, if you are a commentator, then that's different. Then put commentary underneath it. But if you're doing a story, you got to show no bias whatsoever. I mean, if you're not doing that, then you're not doing anybody a favor.
In the old days, in local television here in Los Angeles, how common was it to do the news at 6, go out, have dinner, a couple of cocktails, and then come back for the news at 11?
I was never an anchor, full time. I did anchor once in a while, and I did a lot of sports. But, oh, yeah, there were notorious stories of different places. You know, in fact, there was I didn't put it in the book. I mean, I didn't want to. My book is not a kiss and tell. So people think it's going to be all these, top-notch, little secret stories and what have you. It's not going to be it. I mean, there are little stories in there, different things and what have you. But there used to be a famous bar not far from CBS, and they actually had a straight line. A straight hookup on the phone, where the desk would pick up the phone and the phone would ring exactly to where the bartender was to make certain that a certain anchor was ready to get out of there and go back and do the news.
had to be Jerry Dunphy.
Oh, my God. Let me tell you, you brought up Jerry Dunphy, and this story is in the book. One of the greatest men that I ever worked for, and most people don't even know who he is. His name is Pete Noyes. But if you worked in this business for any length of time, many of us owe our career to him. And he passed away a little over a year ago. But he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was a top-notch professional. Broke the story on the Charlie Manson story. Broke all kinds of other stories. Pete was marvelous. Pete, in his early days, was a writer, producer on the big news. And Jerry Dunphy was the big star. And Pete himself told me the story many times. He said one day Dunphy didn't like the way something was written, and so he asked, who wrote this script? And Pete said, I did. And Dunphy tore it up. Fortunately, there was another man named Mike Daniels who kept the second copy, so it wasn't a complete disaster. So Pete was very mad, Irishman, and he took a swing at Dunphy and missed him. Big, big hassle in the newsroom, okay? So the next day, Pete goes home, gets a call from the next day from the general manager, be in my office in an hour. Well, Pete was convinced he was going to be fired. So Pete's driving in. He goes in the office, sits down with the general manager, and he says, all right, what happened last night? He told him. General manager gets up and looks at Pete and says, Pete, the next time you take a swing and miss that SOB, I'm going to fire you. Now get out of here.
Dave Lopez, the book is It's a Great Life If You Don't Weaken, Family, Faith, and 48 Years on Television. Thanks so much for stopping by. It was a pleasure. Have a wonderful weekend.
Anytime, John. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the kind words. Thank you.
Absolutely. And Randy, Kevin Tripp just reported that the stock market really took a tumble today.
That's right. The Dow closed down over 900 points. The NASDAQ, I believe, closed down 500 points. There's a lot of bad earnings reports. First, you had Netflix early in the week, then Amazon, and then Tesla's stock took a dump because Elon's buying Twitter. And then there's questions, can he afford it now? There's a whole mess.
I'll tell you which stock is in complete free fall, and that's Disney. Have you been watching that one?
No, let's check out the Disney stock ticker. Oh, boy. Disney stock is down 3% today. It's down 20% in the last month, 34% in the last 6 months, but 30% year to date.
Going to war with the state of Florida has not been good for that corporation.
Did they go to war with Florida? Did Florida go to war with them?
Well, it's kind of mutual at this point.
Can they airlift Disney World over to another state?
You know, Donald is a Navy man. And as a shareholder, I can feel very confident in telling Disney, stop it. But that's a different story for a different day. Now, yesterday, we told you how the Beverly Center, which is in one of the safe parts of Los Angeles, but nothing is immune to the California crime wave that is all over the state right now. But the Beverly Center, Randy, they got hit.
That's right. Specifically, a guy walking outside the Beverly Center was doing what you're not supposed to do in L.A. is wearing a nice watch, and he got robbed. And the guy that stole the watch from him at gunpoint ran into the Beverly Center to avoid the cops.
But that's what you do at the Beverly Center. You buy expensive watches.
You can buy a watch. Just don't wear it.
So what? You're supposed to buy the watch from the Beverly Center, keep it in the bag, and only wear it when you visit relatives in Pittsburgh?
I wonder if there are any criminals out there that are technologically advanced to the point where when somebody buys an expensive watch at the Beverly Center and then...
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the Road to a Podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.
I immediately take a picture and put it on Instagram being like, look at my new bling. Do they know to go follow that person and steal the watch immediately?
Criminals are usually pretty dumb, but on the subject of finding marks, they're pretty smart. For more on this, here's Fox 11.
And I saw there was a bunch of women.
Oh, we got the big action music for this one.
Must be sweeps.
And I saw there was a bunch of women and kids, and so I'm yelling gun, like, turn around. And there, people are coming down, and I'm trying to get people to, like, turn around and go up.
Breaking news here at 5 o'clock. A violent robbery in the middle of the day at a popular mall. We speak to a witness who saw it all unfold. Good evening. Welcome to Fox 11 News at 5. I'm Alex Michaels.
And I'm Christine Devine. A crime trend plaguing Los Angeles. This time it happened outside the Beverly Center. That's where we find Fox 11's Chelsea Edwards.
Chelsea, this seemed like this was a pretty quick arrest.
Yeah, thankfully it was, but you can imagine the panic for everybody who was inside that shopping center before they knew what was going on. That is the good news in this case, though, is that that suspect is in custody, but still wild moments here at the Beverly.
That was yesterday at 5 o'clock. You think he's out by now?
Well, George Gascon is the district attorney, so my money says yes.
And even though the pandemic's over, we've still got those pandemic bail rules.
Wild moments here at the Beverly Center before then. So the witness that we talked to says he saw the entire thing. He said he was the one that actually called 911, and it happened right here at this entrance. This is right across from the Sofitel, the Beverly Center entrance across from the Sofitel here on Beverly, and that victim robbed it.
The Sofitel has a beautiful patio, and it's a great place to have drinks if you're waiting for Largo to open up. But the problem is you sit out there, you have your lovely drinks, and you hear nothing but sirens on the streets of that part of Los Angeles now.
Well, because you're right next to Cedars-Sinai, and George Gascon is the district attorney.
Gunpoint while trying to get into a friend's car. He was right here in this pickup area. The witness says he saw the suspect pull out the gun, and that's when he decided he had to just run through this entrance while calling 911. Listen.
I started going up the escalator, and I turn around, and he is behind me running towards me.
The guy with the gun?
The guy with the gun.
Now let me tell you about these escalators, because the escalators are on the side of the mall, and they are totally exposed. There's glass along the side, so you can look out and see what's going on outside the street, and you can see the people on the escalator above you, and the people on the escalator above them, and the people on the escalator above them. So if you've got a nut with a gun, the nut with the gun has access to shoot at a lot of different people.
I started going up the escalator, and I turn around, and he is behind me running towards me.
The guy with the gun?
The guy with the gun. He's running up the escalator towards me. And so at that point, I started hooking up the escalator into the Beverly Center, and I started yelling gun because I saw, and he was coming quick. And I think it's because he saw that I was a witness to this. He got about to like escalator 3 or 4, and I saw there's a bunch of women and kids, and so I'm yelling gun, like turn around, and there people are coming down, and I'm trying to get people to like turn around and go up.
This is why for a few minutes on Twitter yesterday there were people that thought there was an active shooter situation inside the Beverly Center. Because well, there kind around, of was.
Well, yeah, if you're running around screaming gun and there's a guy with a gun and there's a bunch of women and children, that's going to be on Twitter in about 2.2 seconds.
But then there were people downplaying and saying, no, it wasn't an active shooter because he didn't actively shoot the gun.
He just had access to a loaded gun.
The escalator. So I got in the mall and I told everybody, I said gun. I started shouting gun. I told everybody to get in the store, clear out. And all of a sudden they started closing the gates.
how scary to witness that kind of crime and then run as fast as you can into the Macy's and witness the crime of the prices on those jeans.
I mean, you can just hear it in his voice, the panic there, and that must have been the case with everybody who was inside the Beverly Center at that time. Now, police tell us that the suspect had been following that victim prior to the robbery and had then run into the mall's parking lot with the Rolex watch from the victim. But again, he was caught pretty quickly, and they were able to get that Rolex back to the victim.
Michael Moore said, don't wear your Rolexes, but this guy didn't listen.
That's right. Now, if he purchased the Rolex at the mall, there could be someone in there watching who's in the mall with the Rolex, tipping off the other person that then robs them.
You think this is an inside job?
It could be an inside job.
Now, this is, of course, very upscale area. I mean, this is the Beverly Center, seemingly very safe. But incidents like this obviously have people living and working here, people who shop in these places, very, very worried. The good news, though, nobody was hurt in this incident, and that suspect is now in police custody.
You know, it did used to look like a very nice area. It was a very nice area for a very long time. But just that corner right there at La Cienega and Beverly, you've got the Sofitel on one corner, you get the Beverly Center on the other corner, and then the other two corners are gas stations that are occupied by homeless encampments.
And one of them is the gas station that always appears on the news for having gas that's like $1.50 more expensive than everyone else.
And the thing is, if you stop at that gas station, the high prices are the least of your problems.
No kidding. Well, at least Cedars is right around the corner, so you have that going for you.
Hence the sirens constantly when you're walking up and down that area.
It's amazing how many areas used to be nice that now I wouldn't place in that category. And that area is on the bubble right now. Would you feel comfortable buying something expensive from that mall right now?
Absolutely not. But I don't feel either. Comfortable buying anything expensive. I wear t-shirts.
Actor Alec Baldwin just called for more gun control on Instagram.
From him?
I think for everyone else.
He really, at this point, shouldn't even mention the word gun.
In a Friday morning Instagram post, Baldwin wrote, "The very childhoods of our kids interrupted by this insanity. We regulate many things in this country in the interest of public health and safety. Drugs, cars, professional licenses, etc. We need gun control reform. Period. Now. Period."
But there is a ton of regulation when it comes to using guns on movie sets. His crew that he was paying for didn't pay attention to any of that.
All right, let's play a game. I'm going to start asking questions. Randy, how many people have you shot and killed with a gun?
Zero.
John, how many people have you shot and killed with a gun?
Zero.
Alec, how many people have you shot and killed with a gun?
You are a rude, thoughtless little pig, okay?
And if you want to get technical, he shot two people because the bullet went through one of them and into another. It was one of them JFK magic bullets.
He'd be so much better off just leaving it alone, let the investigation happen, but he has to bring the attention to himself and make him look like the victim.
There are some people who just can't help themselves. Alec Baldwin is one of those people. Not going to stop.
He makes it really hard sometimes to watch repeats of 30 Rock, which I love. Not impossible, but he makes it really hard.
You know what? I happen to think the guy's entertaining. So it's like OJ. If we have a district attorney that doesn't care about the crime and they're going to let everyone out of prison, then I'm not going to feel 1% guilty for enjoying the criminals that I like.
What's going on, America?
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.